This is Attuned to Yesterday special. Radio was there, D-Day, by Mark Levonier. One of the most decisive and determinant military actions of World War II took place on June 6, 1944, when a combined Allied force of British, Canadian, and American soldiers landed on the shores of Normandy, France, after a naval bombardment of over 50 miles of the country's coastline in an effort to turn the tide of the war against Germany. There were actually many D-Days during the war, or departure days, with this being the most impactful that was many months in the making and would lead to the liberation of Nazi-occupied France, the opening of a port of entry into Europe to break through what was known as Hitler's Atlantic Wall of Defense, setting up the Allies for victory, which would come a year later. For this major military action, the supreme Allied commander of these forces, General Dwight D. Eisenhower, delivered a radio message to the troops.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you.
And radio listeners were there, where, apart from imagining unnerving scenes of their sons and daughters fighting in war, they stayed informed with the quickest way of getting war news, which was radio. The voices of correspondents may not have put too many at ease, but they delivered the truth as they learned it, fulfilling their duty as our men and women overseas were doing the same. Radio networks CBS, NBC, and the Mutual Broadcasting System banded together in many ways that day to do what was expected of them, to share the news. And that meant sharing reporters, recordings, and information at a time where they were fierce competitors, often mired in legalities and normally on the air, careful not to mention each other. But this day proved to be the turning point in the war that everyone hoped it would be, so time for competition rested with our fighting men and women and not radio executives. Since June 6, 1944, thousands of accounts of D-Day have been told. On the day itself, several radio reporters were actually on the scene and rushed recordings from the battlefront to studios in England. This remarkable account from CBS Radio's Charles Collingwood was heard on the air in the States about 12 hours after the start of the invasion.
We are on the beach today on D-Day. We've just come in. We caught a ride in a small boat which came in from our LST loaded with 1,000 pounds of TNT. Half a ton of high explosive on this beach, which is still under considerable enemy gunfire. While we have been here, we have just seen one of the strangest and most remarkable sights of this invasion so far. Two great fleets of over 100 gliders have gone overhead, towed by C-47 transports, who are certainly proving the workhorses of this invasion. They've hauled them right over the beaches, and the second batch are droning over now. I can see them. They're casting off the gliders as they circle around over the beach, and the transports are circling around and beginning to make off home. And here comes another flight, the third flight of gliders, which is being pulled in. I can't count how many of them there are. They're coming in over the beach here. More and more and more of these glider-borne troops are coming in. These gliders are coming in towed very soon by the big C-47s in what is apparently an unending stream.
These boys are apparently having a pretty tough time in here on the beaches. It's not very pleasant. It's exposed, and it must have been a rugged fight to get it. We can look on down the coast now and see this flat part of the beach, which joins the water, going all the way down to the lower beach, which is marked for us by columns of white smoke which are rising from it. And further up at the end of this beach, we can see another huge column of white smoke, which has apparently been caused by naval gunfire. Looking out to sea, all we can see of the vast invasion fleet which is assembled for us are the silhouettes of the big warships, the battleships and cruisers, which have been putting a steady bombardment against the enemy positions all day. The troops are well dug in here along the seawall, which is partly covered by sand. They're sitting down now, most of them, dug deep into the ground, as close as they can to the seawall to protect themselves from the enemy shelling. We're standing here. It's an absolutely incredible and fantastic sight. I don't know whether it's possible to describe it to you or not. It's late in the afternoon. The sun is going down. The sea is choppy, and the beach is lined with men and materials and guns, trucks, vehicles of all kinds. On either side of us, there are pillars of smoke, perhaps a mile, 2 miles away, which is rising from enemy shelling. And further back, we can see the smoke and results of our own shelling. This place even smells like an invasion. It has a curious odor, which we always associate with modern war. It's a smell of oil and high explosive and burning things. This has been a momentous occasion for all of us.
Back in the States, news reports were given throughout the day. At 11 at night on CBS Radio, their staff newsman Ned Kalmer and commentator Quincy Howe brought listeners the latest from the front.
Continuing its up-to-the-minute coverage of the invasion, CBS World News now presents 15 minutes of news and analysis. First, a summary of the latest developments by Ned Kalmer, followed by an analysis by Quincy Howe. Mr. Kalmer.
At a solemn moment in our national history, President Roosevelt has led the American people in prayer for the fighting men who tonight are entering the second day of their invasion on the Normandy coast of France.
And here's a few moments from that prayer where President Roosevelt addressed the nation.
Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. For the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed, but we shall return again and again. And we know that by thy grace and by the righteousness of our cause, our sons will triumph.
The President also brought us, less than an hour ago, the latest word on military operations. Thus far, he said, they have been successful. Meantime, the first of the Allied wounded are returning to Britain, and the thoughts of the whole civilized world are with them, and with their comrades who are still in the midst of the fight. It's now more than 24 hours since our invasion got underway, and it's a good moment to look back over the welter of millions of words that have poured in on us to see just what is clear and definite in the picture. There are only two trustworthy sources, the communiques from General Eisenhower's quarters and the statements by Allied leaders, notably President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill. The German communiques, though they may be misleading and exaggerated, must be taken into consideration at this stage of the invasion when so much is happening and so little is officially revealed by our side. Then there's the unending series of reports and rumors from neutral cities in Europe, which may or may not be skillfully planted Nazi propaganda. They have to be sifted, and if they look probable, they ought to be mentioned. But first, what's disclosed officially by the Allies? The communique from Allied headquarters on the first day's operations says that our initial landings in northern France were successful. It says the fighting continues under command of General Montgomery, that our naval casualties have been very light, but it doesn't specify as to land casualties so far. Our planes, it says, continued operations in very great strength all day, and continuous fighter cover is being maintained over both our naval and land forces. The communique also reveals that two naval task forces launched assaults on France this morning, and they include the cruiser Augusta under Admiral Kirk and the cruiser Tuscaloosa under Admiral Dale. President Roosevelt gave his first report on the invasion by saying that operations are so far up to schedule. As of noon, American ship losses were 2 destroyers and 1 landing ship, he said, and aircraft losses about 1%. The battleship Nevada is in action. Mr. Churchill's reports are being given to the House of Commons, where he appeared twice today. It was Churchill who disclosed that Allied troops have penetrated 9.5 miles inland and have been fighting at the town of Caen, C-A-E-N, in Normandy. He seemed well pleased, even surprised, that our losses have been so slight up to now. But he warned that it's much too early to tell what course the battle may take in the coming days and weeks. Our troops have established lodgments, he said, on a broad front, and it appears we've achieved a tactical surprise. The Prime Minister called all these operations the most complicated and difficult which have ever occurred. Around Eisenhower's headquarters also, considerable optimism is reported, despite the fact that the weather on the channel, which has been against us more than once in this war, is none too satisfactory at this hour. The weather element, it's now revealed, actually forced a postponement of the invasion by 24 hours. Originally, it was set by Eisenhower for the night of June 4 to 5. May or June are now known to have been the months selected for the invasion as long ago as the Tehran Conference. German reconnaissance was also caught sound asleep. It wasn't until after our armada of ships was well on its way from Britain that an enemy channel patrol spotted our movements not long before dawn. Our troops started out on their fateful mission in a gay but determined mood. We know definitely also that we maintain air superiority, that 11,000 planes are backing our invasion, that our airborne and paratroop actions were successful and our losses in those planes small, and that about 4,000 Allied warships are supporting the landings and continuing to move reinforcements to the beachhead. But just where those beachheads are, other than the action in the Caen area mentioned by Mr. Churchill, has not been stated by the Allied command. To give official details on that would be to hand the Germans valuable information free. Our only detailed reports on this, however, come from the German high command. It's generally accepted that we put men ashore from landing craft at a number of points between the ports of Cherbourg and Le Havre, which we have shelled in the Bay de la Seine, where the Seine River empties into the channel. It's probable that our troops poured ashore on the vast white beaches of Deauville and its neighboring resorts, once so popular with Americans of the pre-war era. The German communique claims to have knocked out our airborne forces south of Le Havre and dropped and trapped our troops at the mouth of the River Orne. There's an enemy report of battling near Rouen. Very heavy fighting continues along a front, estimated variously by the Nazis, from 15 to 100 miles in length. Within the past few hours, the Nazis have been reporting imminent new landings by the Allies. They say a British-American naval squadron is standing off Cherbourg and expect action in the region of Dunkirk and Calais. And a rumor in Turkey says the Allies have landed in Greece. Absolutely no confirmation from our side. One remarkable fact among all these developments is the poor showing of the German Air Force, said to have put only about 50 planes in the air so far today, though Marshal Goering is quoted as saying, "We must repel the invasion, even if it means the death of the Luftwaffe." But on this, as well as a great many other aspects of the invasion, we may know much more within the next 2 or 3 days. The European underground, obedient to its orders, has not yet risen in full strength. General Eisenhower, now directing operations from a trailer in England, will give the word. General de Gaulle may be in France soon. The other war fronts tonight are naturally out of the limelight, but in Europe they're going to become increasingly important as our vast three-way squeeze develops. In Russia, though the Red Army has not yet begun its expected offensive, American bombers and fighters made their first strike from bases in the Soviet Union, a raid on the German airfield at Galati in Romania. In Italy, where life in Rome is being swiftly returned to normal by the Allied military government, French troops have captured the road junction at Tivoli to the northeast of Rome, and the Fifth Army is pursuing the enemy to the north and west. In the war against Japan, our troops on Biak Island off New Guinea are now within a mile and a half of Mokma Airfield and increasing their pressure all the time. The Burma fighting goes well for the Allies, but in China, the Japs have now fought their way into the outskirts of Changsha. On D-Day, there was no wild rejoicing in our own country. President Roosevelt's prayer has exemplified the American reaction. Flag waving is at a minimum. Many communities are holding solemn meetings. Some festive events have been canceled. War workers everywhere kept on working. But all of us have felt, despite the gravity of the hour, a sense of relief that the waiting, at least, the long period of suspense, is over. In Dallas, Texas, by the way, the invasion already has its first namesake. Invasia May Renfrew was born to a trucker's wife as the sirens sounded. The invasion news has been coming in now for nearly 24 hours on a wave of world excitement which hasn't yet reached its crest. You may have been one of those who were listening to their radio shortly after 12:30 a.m. Eastern wartime when the first bulletin broke. That was an Associated Press dispatch from London quoting the German radio as saying that the invasion of Western Europe had begun. At that moment, CBS News Director Paul White alerted his staff, although it wasn't until 3:32 a.m. that the news was officially confirmed by Allied headquarters. Until then, there was always the possibility that the Germans were perpetrating a hoax with the hope of smoking out the French underground. So the CBS staff stood by, keeping its network open and keeping its audience informed on what the enemy was saying. The first genuine tip-off came when the British radio told the Dutch that Le Havre was under bombardment. Meantime, the veteran CBS correspondent Bob Trout was giving listeners a running account of developments from our newsroom just outside this studio where I'm speaking now, carrying around a portable microphone as he went to the various news machines, bringing in the reports in ever-increasing tempo. The CBS military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott, then joined our coverage from New York, and it was while Elliott and Trout were reporting from the newsroom that London gave us the first official communique from Eisenhower's headquarters, simply announcing that Allied forces with strong naval and air support had landed in northern France. Then the voice of Edward R. Murrow, chief of the CBS European staff, came on in London, and Quentin Reynolds joined the broadcasters here in New York. That's the world news picture as D-Day ends. But if you're interested in numerology, you might want to know that the European invasion started on the sixth hour of the sixth day of the sixth month, in curious contrast with the end of the last war, which ended on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month.
You've been listening to Ned Kalmer in a summary of the news.
The program continued with the voice of Quincy Howe, who was a broadcasting pioneer in his own right and would be instrumental in making news analysis an acceptable practice on the air.
Each night at the same time, CBS World News brings you an analysis of the latest news developments. Tonight, Quincy Howe.
This has been a day of action abroad, a day of talk, reflection, and emotion at home. You've heard by now all the essential known facts about the Allied landings in Western Europe. They boil down to this. Allied forces have carried out their first operations on schedule with surprisingly small losses. This news, brief as it is, has immediate significance for every country in the world. To the peoples of occupied Europe, it means that their hour of liberation draws near. But their hour of liberation is also their hour of trial. We shall presently learn the real strength of the underground resistance movement in France. General de Gaulle and the French Committee now have their opportunity to prove their claim to represent their country. The White House State Department policy of non-recognition now meets its practical test. The exiled governments, which we do recognize, also approach their testing time. What strength and following have any of the resistance groups in Europe mustered? To whom do these groups look for leadership? To exiled leaders or to people in their own ranks? How do they feel about the British and the Americans, about our political plans, our air bombardments, our blockade? Are the people of Europe ripe for revolution? Do they want to exterminate all Germans? We don't need to speculate on how the British and the Russians feel. Today, the British Army has begun to pay back the Germans for the defeat at Dunkirk. But the British have non-military objectives, too. The part they're playing in this invasion puts them in position to become the controlling, if not the dominating, power in Western Europe after the war. Most of the exile governments have maintained headquarters in London, and they and their people owe the British a heavy debt, which the British are in position to collect. Provided, that is, that British casualties do not run up to nearly a million men as they did during the last war. For the British, with their declining birth rate, cannot lose another million young men and expect to remain a great power, especially now that they must double their export trade after the war in order to make up for the loss of revenue from foreign investments that the war has liquidated. The Russians have suffered far heavier losses than the British, but they have far greater reserves of manpower and natural resources on which to draw. As a great power, perhaps the great power of the second half of the 20th century, the Russians simply cannot miss. Today's landings in Western Europe not only improve Russia's military prospects by confronting Hitler with a three-front war, the Russians now have tangible, practical proof that they can do business with Britain and the United States in war, and if war, in war, why not in peace? These prospects depress the Germans, and the Japanese, too, every bit as much as they gratify the Russians. The Germans now have this three-front military war in their hands, and the Anglo-Soviet-American coalition never looked stronger. And the prospects of Germany's defeat means that Japan's day of reckoning draws near, with Russia more closely tied to the Anglo-American powers. But for the United States, today's news has a unique significance. If our fighting men are not carrying more than their share of the first attack, it's at any rate certain that American supplies, American resources, and American reserves form the backbone of the whole vast enterprise of liberating Western Europe. Yet no responsible American has suggested that Europe be divided into spheres of influence. The whole sense of President Roosevelt's prayer was that our country is fighting for a better world, and we've put far more into this war than we put into the last one when we fought for the same general purpose. For this war has brought the United States to the peak of its military, its economic, and its moral power. The United States has now thrown all this power into the greatest military campaign and the most ambitious program of popular liberation in all history. Our military prospects look good, but whether victory comes quick or slow, its cost comes high. At this moment in history, no nation can challenge our position or our power. How responsibly we use that position and that power will determine the future of our people.
That was Quincy Howe in another analysis presented by CBS World News. Tomorrow night, William L. Shirer. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
An 11 p.m. broadcast from CBS Radio. And reflecting on D-Day coverage on the air, Radio Life magazine said that radio brought a fireside seat at the most tragic and biggest military show in history. And in between news updates, other shows did roll on. Following the news broadcast we just heard, CBS turned to singer Joan Brooks for a break in their evening coverage.
At this time, Columbia brings you Joan Brooks. We will interrupt this program to bring you any late news developments.
If you were the only boy in the world.
And NBC provided music breaks as well while more information was gathered.
Last half hour, NBC has brought you from Chicago music by Roy Shield and the orchestra, and featuring the songs of Gene McKenna and Richard Page. Stay tuned to your NBC station for all the latest news of developments on the invasion front. The National Broadcasting Company has mobilized its entire news-gathering staff in order to bring you the most comprehensive possible coverage of the world-shaking events now taking place on the continent of Europe.
And a very interesting radio experiment happened on CBS earlier in the evening, where they tapped one of their master storytellers of the air, John Nesbitt, and his program, The Passing Parade, to take a look at the events and impact of D-Day in a very unique way.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, for June the 6th and the 31st chapter in the 1944 series of our Passing Parade. The time is exactly 100 years from today. The scene is a schoolroom on a beautiful day in June the 6th, 2044, and you and I are long since in our graves. The furniture around us in our living rooms at this moment has been lost or become expensive antiques in the art stores. And those newspapers with the huge headlines that are now lying near the radio set will have become yellow, brittle documents preserved in the great museums of this day, 100 years from now. In their classroom of plastic and metal, our great-great-grandchildren are gathered, waiting for the lesson to begin. They'll be staring out through the glass walls, wishing they were anywhere in the world but stuck in a schoolroom, having to look at a lot more historical moving pictures flashed on the screen, hearing transcriptions of radio broadcasts that were given generations ago, staring down at microfilm newsreels showing the people of 1944 dressed in their funny clothes and living their funny, forgotten lives. Now the old history professor comes in. And he stands beside the picture screen and he smiles around at the drowsy young faces of our great-great-grandchildren and says, "Does anyone here know what day this is?" No answer. Well, it is exactly 100 years ago today that one of the greatest events since the fall of Rome took place on the face of the earth. That event, young ladies and gentlemen, was called the invasion of Europe by the democracies.
Even NBC Radio's famous comedy team of Fibber McGee and Molly, who drew tens of millions of listeners a week, stood aside for D-Day news coverage.
Ladies and gentlemen, Molly and I and our sponsor would like to say that we're mighty proud to be associated with the radio industry, which at this moment is fulfilling its promise of instant communication in time of world crisis.
The next half hour will be devoted to bringing you information immediately as received by NBC's news bureaus.
Between times, we will present songs of the services, played and sung by Billy Mills Orchestra, the King's Men, and dedicated to our fighting forces on all fronts.
And now for music, and the news as it arrives, as Billy Mills gives us a George M. Cohan medley.
And one of the most popular singers of World War II, best known for her rendition of God Bless America, Kate Smith, took to the air with a powerful D-Day message.
Hello, everybody. Today is a day that no living American can ever forget. Invasion Day, forged into our consciousness in letters of fire. It marks the pinnacle of weeks and months and years of anguished preparation, the consolidating of our mighty forces. This is the hour of the death blow to those, our enemies, who have spread evil, sorrow, and suffering like a black shadow across the face of this earth. This is the day of reckoning, when America and her allies go forward to the terrible task of crushing completely and forever the enemies who for 4.5 years have ravaged one helpless nation after another. This is the day that must mark the beginning of the downfall of Nazi Germany and the downfall of all those who have sanctioned and aided the brief reign of terror, the cruelty, insanity, and arrogance of Hitlerism. Let the blow be swift and sure. Let us be strong and unswerving in purpose, strong in the assurance that we go forward in a cause which is right, in the liberation of the oppressed and the restoration of human decency and dignity from the forces of evil. This is Invasion Day, Liberation Day. Here at home, we sit beside our radios, eagerly hanging on each word of news that flashes across an ocean around the world. We're filled with a conflict of many emotions, fear, excitement, and hope. But these emotions will not help those whom we most desire to help. They will not carry our brave fighting forces forward unless we harness those thoughts and guide them and use their power to forge an invincible weapon against the foe. Today, we cannot afford to stand idly by, scattering our thoughts so haphazardly that they reap only the wind. We must concentrate them on victory and turn our earnest, united thought into devout, unceasing prayer to God. Wherever you are at this moment, whatever you are doing, join your prayers with mine, a prayer for victory. Pray that our crusaders may be strong, that success will crown their every effort. Pray that they may speedily accomplish their mission and bring their adversaries to unconditional surrender. Pray to our Father in heaven to look down with compassion upon this sick and sorrowing world and guide the forces of right against the forces of evil and insanity. If millions of us, every man, woman, and child in America, will lift our fervent prayers to God, those prayers will be answered. You all know the power of faith and prayer. Use that power now. Use it with every fiber of your heart and soul and mind so that your prayers, along with mine, may reach outward and upward to encompass and aid those we love and the cause for which they crusade. Lift up your prayers for victory and for peace to him who said, "Ask, and ye shall receive." And now, Ted, what's new?
Allied invasion forces are storming ashore along northern France this noon, taking the first long step to Berlin from a bridge of ships stretching across the English Channel. And the most important news of the hour, in the words of Prime Minister Churchill, is that operations are proceeding according to plan. Never before in history has the world seen anything like the invasion armada that stands between England and France and fills the skies above. 11,000 planes, 4,000 ships, and thousands of smaller craft are in action. And when the invasion was only hours old, the good news came through that we have seized beachheads, which threaten the whole Normandy Peninsula, and a rail line that runs right into Paris. The British radio says that we have a firm grip on two beachheads and that Allied formations are advancing inland possibly as much as 10 miles. Meantime, the German DNB news agency has admitted dolefully that American tanks have been put ashore in at least one sector.
CBS Radio's rolling coverage continued with well-known news voices like Robert or Bob Trout, regarded as one of radio's best special coverage reporters, on D-Day alone, working for almost 24 hours straight. And then there was reporter George Hicks, who had pressured his NBC radio employer a year earlier to open a London office during the war, where at first he was the only staff. After getting some help, he would report from the battlefield for several of the conflicts in the European theater, but none became more famous than his on-the-ground telling of the D-Day invasion. a recording that was made available to all networks and will be broadcast repeatedly in the days to follow. Here's the CBS report that featured that recording.
We've been informed now that shortly we expect to be able to go to London and to bring you the full recording which we'd introduced a few moments ago. That is, the eyewitness recording of the shore bombardment preceding the invasion and a description of Allied landing craft given by George Hicks. Go ahead, London.
This is George Hicks speaking. I'm speaking now from the tower above the signal bridge of an American naval flagship, and we're lying some few miles off the coast of France where the invasion of Europe has begun. It's now 20 minutes to 6, and the landing craft have been disembarked from their mothership and moving in long, irregular lines toward the horizon of France, which is very plain to the naked eye. Our own bombardment fleet, lying out beyond us, has begun to blast the shoreline, and we can see the vivid yellow bursts of flame quite clearly, although the sound is too far away to be heard, and at the same time, from the shore, are answering yellow flames as the Nazi batteries are replying. Overhead, flames are high up in the thin cloud, which is a gray screen over the sky, but which is not thick nor heavy, and not low enough to be an inconvenience to bombing. The LCTs and the LCIs have begun to pass along the side of us. Those are the amphibious beach landing craft that carry the tanks, trucks, bulldozers, and finally the men ashore. They've been churning along and are bouncing around in the choppy channel sea now. And all around us, on either side, are stretched the fast transports at anchor who have disembarked these small craft. They, all over the surface of the sea here, can be seen cutting and zigzagging and then forming into those somewhat irregular lines that make a black pencil point across the sea itself, heading toward the ribbon of land that France and the coast of Normandy. We can see the wreaths of smoke that are beginning to puff up, both black and white, on the shoreline. France, at this particular part of its northwestern seacoast, has a rather shallow beach and then steep cliffs of 100 to 200 feet, and then the rolling land beyond. This area is between Cherbourg and Le Havre. The wind has increased rather than diminished during the night and is now blowing an 18 knot wind, which is pretty stiff and is kicking up white caps. However, the landing beach craft are going in and are plowing through the choppy sea and seem to be making good headway. The order of the attack is for a naval bombardment, an air bombardment, and then landing craft going in carrying tanks, then a wave of infantry to take the first toehold on the beaches, and then a wave of the beach demolition engineers who will knock out with hand charges the underwater obstacles and those on the shore itself. It's now becoming quite clear and daylight as 6 a.m. approaches on June 6, 1944. Occasionally, in the stiff wind that's whipping around our platform, we can hear the thud of shells or bombs landing on the French coastline, perhaps 8 or 10 miles before us. And the steel plates on which we stand vibrate from the concussion of the heavy guns that are firing from the American and British battleships and heavy cruisers forming a long line right behind us. I can count 22 of the squat, square-nosed landing craft carrying vehicles along one side of us as they turn and bounce in the choppy sea, waiting the exact timing to broaden their lines and start in toward the beach.
When I first began speaking to you, it was the shore batteries of the Nazis that had spotted us here at sea and opened up, and our naval bombardment squad has replied to them. One battleship is in as close as 3 miles. And one of these famous American battleships, the Texas, is out 6 miles in her firing position. A duel is in progress now between a battleship lying just a couple of miles off the French shore and firing broadsides into the land. The Germans are replying from the land with flashes, and then the battleship lets go with its entire broadside again. A very side of the battle wagon lights up in a yellow glare as her broadside goes off, and now we can see brown gray smoke drifting up from her, from her gun barrels. Huge mushrooms of black and gray smoke are beginning to pile up off the beach hoods of France. Directly before us, probably air bombardment. The two columns are beginning to rise higher than the hills behind them. And to the left is another single column. It's just burst then on the top of the cliff above the chalk wall facing the sea, and puffs of smoke are standing up now like plumes. A fire has been started on the beach front directly before us, and now batteries are firing from the beach, flashes of yellow, and the broadsides of the battleship are pouring it back at them. Overhead, high, planes are roaring. I think they just came in and dropped a salvo of bombs, the sick, on that the hilltop directly before it that we spoke of a moment ago. A mass flight of flying fortresses are passing over the invasion fleet. Perhaps you can hear the roaring of their motors. 36, 38 planes against the wind that's rushing through the ring of this mass top. Heavy bombardment, naval guns, ships seem to be even closer to the French shore now, hugging in along the coastline and blasting out their blossoms of yellow fire. There have been replies from the shore, but low gray pink clouds have set down over the coast of France. For a moment now, we're unable to see the outline of the land. Although over into the east, the sky has opened up. The loudspeaker on this flagship has been announcing almost continuously. The Spitfires on our starboard bow. T-38, dead ahead. The air support, here it comes for T-38 now, following the fort. The air has simply been crisscrossed with allied planes of all types. The tank carrying and vehicle carrying landing craft have passed our ship and are beginning to form their line, which is already pointed toward the French coast. The earlier and smaller LCVTs, which carry infantry and personnel, have been en route now over 40 minutes, and according to the time schedule, should be hitting the French shore in 10 minutes from now. Everywhere you look in this jangled English Channel, which is green and gold with the rips of the sunlight coming through broken clouds, everywhere you look are big and little ships of all kinds, the types that you almost have never seen before. The wind seems to be increasing in velocity, and it looks as though weather has turned a bit against it on the opening day's day.
The Augusta, one of America's sailors' cruisers, is in off the shore there blasting, as well as the Texas, the Nevada, and the Arkansas. Old battleships and slow, but with terrific armaments. 14-inch guns. They're just anchored off and blowing into the Nazi batteries on shore.
It's now just a couple of minutes past 6:30 in the morning. First, Allied forces are reaching the beaches in France. And that's the latest news that we can bring you from the invasion beachhead as it just now reaches H hour. This is George Kinsley. I now return you to the United States.
Back at Columbia's news headquarters in New York, what we have been hearing is the first eyewitness recording of the shore bombardment preceding the actual landings of the invasion and a description of Allied landing craft going into their beach. It's a recording which was made on D-Day just before H hour by George Hicks, who was representing the Combined American Networks. And the recording was played for us in London. Incidentally, you may have heard Mr. Hicks speak of the weather. He mentioned it several times and said it was worsening. He said the wind was picking up, and at one point he said there was a wind with a velocity of 18 knots. About an hour ago, I believe it was, Columbia's correspondent in London gave us a fresh dispatch, which, of course, was a later dispatch than George Hicks' recording, and Mr. Merrill told us that the weather in the channel is definitely worse. Mr. Merrill's news was almost 24 hours later than Mr. Hicks' recording. Mr. Merrill said there's a strong wind blowing across the channel tonight, and sizable waves are hitting the beaches, which will increase our problems of supply. Also, Mr. Merrill said that Britain's big bombers, the big heavy night bombers of the Royal Air Force, have again crossed the channel, but so far tonight we have no details. Late this evening, according to Royal Air Force pilots returning from low-level flights over the beachheads, the Allied troops are moving inward. The Royal Air Force pilots report that there is no longer any opposition on the beaches on which we landed. These beaches are now completely in Allied hands. And one of the returning Royal Air Force pilots said, "We could tell easily that the beaches are secure. We could see our soldiers below standing up. We could see our tanks moving up on Caen. And in the area inland, we saw several fires. They looked like gasoline dumps. When we left after the last sorties, we could see no enemy infantry at this point near the coast. Our balloons were already over the landing beaches, guarding the ships from low-level attack by any German fighters which might be about. But the lack of air opposition from the German Air Force was fantastic." That's the word that these Royal Air Force fighter pilots who made low-level flights over the beachheads, that's the word they used to describe the lack of air opposition from the German Air Force. They say, fantastic. And now here's a word from an American transport pilot, Lieutenant James B. Crawley of Springfield, Illinois, a United States Army 9th Air Force C-47 transport pilot who flew two loads of paratroops and supplies behind the German lines in the invasion, reports that on his last trip Tuesday, he saw American soldiers lounging on the French roads. He could look down below and see them there. And Lieutenant Crawley said the doughboys were leaning on their rifles and they were quietly awaiting mess call. A German broadcast, which was heard here in New York tonight, said that heavy German tank attacks have been launched against the Allied beachhead east of Cherbourg. This German broadcast, beamed to the United States, claims that beachhead forces have been wiped out 15 miles northwest of Caen and also Isigny, which is 32 miles west-northwest of the town of Caen. That's a German broadcast. It was made in the English language. It was beamed to the United States. It is what the Germans want us to think at this moment. We have no news of any kind that has anything to do with that information, if that's what we shall call it, which has been sent in a German broadcast beamed to the United States. Bring you up to date a little bit. We were going to go to England, as a matter of fact, in a few moments. We're still waiting for the signal, and I'll bring you up to date a little bit farther before we make the switch. Earlier, if you were with us, you heard us telling you that the first ground forces to land on the French beaches were Americans. But about an hour before the landing was made on the beaches, combined British and American paratroopers shared the honors of being the first soldiers to set foot on French soil. These paratroopers battled the Germans for several hours before the main landings on the beaches. A bit later, we got a dispatch from the Canadians, and that dispatch tells us that the men who sought revenge for the landing at Dieppe took just 2 hours and 45 minutes to establish the beachhead assigned to them. The Canadians overcame numerous steel and wooden obstacles placed in the tidal approaches, and they also plowed through fierce enemy beachhead fire. And then the Canadians went on to stiff street fighting in little coast towns. We're still waiting at Columbia's news headquarters here in New York for word that our Columbia correspondent in London is ready. We haven't had such word. And so while we're waiting, Columbia's war correspondent Quentin Reynolds has been sitting at the desk beside me here in our news headquarters. He was going to speak to us a bit later after we'd picked up London. We'll have London shortly, we expect. And now here is Quentin Reynolds to discuss for us the relationship between United States and British troops taking part in the landings. Quentin Reynolds.
A few moments ago, a report came in here from London saying that today General Montgomery held a press conference at which he told correspondents that he had just received a present, a brand new watch, from a group of Americans. It's a good watch, too, Monty grinned to the correspondents. It keeps time. Then Montgomery added, I always get along well with Americans. In one of the earlier reports from a London CBS correspondent today, we heard that the cooperation between American and British troops had been beautiful. This gift to the general from a group of American civilians is merely a reflection of the fine cooperation which exists between the British and the American fighting men once they get into action. This comes as no surprise to anyone who has been with our troops abroad and has been with the British abroad. Comes as no surprise to anyone who knows how General Eisenhower operates. This might be a good time to bring the whole subject of relations between British and American troops right out into the open. 2 years ago, we used to hear of occasional clashes in London between American and British soldiers. They would meet at dances, at pubs. They'd have a few beers, and sometimes a careless word would be spoken. The fur would fly, and stories would go out that British and Americans just couldn't get along. The truth of it is, and I was there in London then, that the British and American soldiers had no chance to meet on any common ground of respect for each other. They only knew each other when they were on leave, playing. Then we landed in North Africa, and the real fighting began for us. Our boys found it tough. It was the first time they'd been in combat. Finally, they joined forces with Montgomery's 8th Army. Now, for the first time, they got a chance to see the British soldier in action. The 8th Army had learned its trade the hard way through 3 hard, bitter years of desert fighting. This was probably the greatest of all armies. Our boys now looked at the British through different eyes. These were fighting devils who never asked what the odds were. The 8th Army had a motto, attack and pursue. Our boys liked that. It's the American tradition to like offensive fighters. Jack Dempsey is still a hero to millions of us. The 8th Army is the Jack Dempsey of this war. When General Eisenhower was selected to be the supreme commander of all Allied forces, the greatest cheers came from British officers and men who recognized the genius of this brilliant yet human American commander. Then Eisenhower, looking the field over, chose as his ground commander General Montgomery. He asked Montgomery whom he would like to have as his second in command. Monty didn't hesitate a moment. He immediately said, General Omar Bradley. Bradley commanded the 2nd Corps in the Sicilian campaign. In our high command, no distinction was made as to whether an officer was American or British. The only question was, who was the best man?
While the D-Day invasion may have been the beginning of the end of World War II, the Battle of Normandy, codenamed Operation Overlord, which began on D-Day on June 6, 1944, moved on through late August of that year.
As the hours grew into days and weeks, the liberation of France progressed. Broadcasts of Radio France described the retreat of the Wehrmacht tanks from Paris.
Hello, New York. Hello, London. This is the French National Broadcasting. We take pleasure in bringing you the greetings of Paris that is fighting, but that is also at the ease of its liberation. The Germans are still occupying certain points of the capital, but we have already the possibility to speak to you.
Hello, New York. Hello, Quebec. Hello, London.
Good night to you all.
On August 25th, 1944, the liberation of Paris. As the year ended, another speech was heard. It was addressed to the German people and showed none of the extravagant histrionics and braggadocio they had come to expect from their Führer. In the months that followed, the voice of the Führer became more silent. And in April 1945, ceased forever. The silence that engulfed the Third Reich was broken by the voice of the Supreme Allied Commander.
The Allied force, which invaded Europe on June 6, 1944, has, with its great Russian allies and forces advancing from the south, utterly defeated the Germans by land, sea, and air.
This recording is from 1964, which commemorated the 20th anniversary of the invasion, narrated by Quentin Reynolds, who we heard give commentary in our previous broadcast.
Today on the beaches of Normandy, the calls of seabirds and the laughter of children are heard. On occasion, the faint rumble of surf sounds like the echo of guns, but mostly there is peace. May this peace continue. It has been written, grant us grace fearlessly to contend against evil and to make no peace with oppression, and that we may reverently use our freedom, help us to employ it in the maintenance of justice among men and nations.
And so closes our remembrance of one of the most important and consequential actions of the Second World War with some of the sounds from D-Day on June 6, 1944. This has been Attuned to Yesterday's special. Be with us again for more programs from radio's golden age. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.